history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that you've probably never heard before that you're going to be thankful you did hear by the time we're done. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I'm in Chula Vista, California with 93-year-old Dr. Robert Thomas. I'm going to take the liberty of calling him Bob because I'm guessing that's what they called him growing up in Los Angeles many, many years ago. He's going to take us on quite a journey today through the war in Europe during World War II. There's some mystery, some intrigue, maybe even some confused history that he's going to try to sort out for us by the time we're done. But Bob, let's start out. Your childhood, you had a couple brothers and a sister. Growing up in Southern California, what was that like?
It was wonderful. I can remember living in Long Beach, going through junior high school, graduating from Woodrow Wilson High School.
What were the things you did as a kid? And I know you spent 40 years as an optometrist. Were you thinking as a kid, hey, I'm going to be an eye doctor someday?
When I returned from the military, I didn't know what direction to go. I got a job at a mortuary, strange as it may seem. And when I worked at the mortuary, I was able to have a place to stay. I found out that I'd like to get some degree, and then I went on and I became an optometrist in 1959.
Well, here's what I'm wondering. So that's what you ended up doing. That's after you make it home from the war and after you work at the mortuary. What about when you were a kid? What were your dreams or ambitions when you were a boy?
I had wonderful parents, and I had a great time in grammar school. As far as high school, I was involved in sports and great time there. When I was in high school, the worst thing we ever did was ditch class. But while I was in high school, I held a record of rope climbing with a long, long rope. I don't know, maybe 30 or 40 feet. At that time, you don't use your legs. You just arm it. Mm-hmm. And I was up and down before you could believe it. I think I still, after all these years, hold a record at the Woodrow Wilson High School in rope climbing. So I had a good childhood, and I had a lot of buddies. When I was in junior high school, I got a job at a market right on the street. The cashier was there at the register and the stand, and I was just behind her, and I was in the butcher shop, which was closed on that day. I was filling paper sacks full of sugar. Uh-huh. That was my job. And then all of a sudden, a car pulls up at the curb just 10 feet, 20 feet away. And a guy comes in, and he says, "Give me your money," to the cashier. And she's putting the money on the stand. And then he says, "You see that guy?" And there was another guy in the car he just got out of. He was sticking a double-barrel shotgun out. He says, "You see that shotgun there?" He says, "Do you have any money?" And I says, "No, I don't have any money, only the cashier." So he goes back to the cashier, and she puts the money out on the counter and everything. And then he comes over to me, and then he says, "Kid, give me something to put my money in." All I had was those small sugar bakes, and I plopped them up there. And he says, "Don't you have anything bigger?" "No." I says, "No." So I did give him, I don't know, it's a stack of paper sacks. And so he grabbed it, put the money in, and gone.
Well, that'll get your attention. And I think there was something else that got your attention. If I do the math, you must have been 15 years old when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. What do you remember about December 7th, 1941?
Headlines everywhere. Everybody talking about it. And no one really was aware of the severity of the whole situation. But that was the start of Americanism, I think.
How did you see things change after that? How did your life change?
I was wounded in village fighting. I was blown off of a hill by German rockets called Screaming Mimis. And I ended up in an evac center, which happened to be a palace, and with crystal chandeliers. They didn't have evac centers before I was there, and so the lieutenants, they took over a castle. So anyway, as I lay in a stretcher on the floor, I was very, very nauseated. I looked up at the ceiling, and I could see the crystal chandelier rotating round and round and round. I was bleeding from both ears, and I couldn't hear anything, and it was not a good time. So from evac center to a hospital, from a hospital to a tent, and the tent was rehab. And I was alone in this tent, and an officer from my 90th Infantry Division came into the tent, and he says, "Private," he says, "I need you." And he says, "I want you to ride with me and check out some of the villages." So he took me to his Harley Davidson motorcycle. I was shotgun. I took the place as a shotgun. And he handed me a .45 grease gun. So I hopped on and away we went. And by coincidence, we did find a village that was different from all the others. And this village had a tall smokestack and no smoke coming out of it. And so we decided to investigate, the lieutenant and I. And so we finally went down to the salt mine, and everybody was sticking white flags out. So we pulled the cycle up to the gate. About 8 or 10 men in long white coats came and just caused a ruckus at the gate. And the lieutenant says, "Who's in charge?" And one of the guys in the white coats, and they had automatic weapons hidden underneath their white coats. And so, "Who's in charge?" And the man pointed to a tall house with a bay window sticking out in the front across the street. So anyway, we went across the street, and the kind lady took us upstairs to a room, opened a door for us, and we went in the door, and she closed the door. The room was empty, so we stood there for a couple of minutes while the curtains in the bay window pulled back, exposing a civilian. He said he was the mine director. And so the lieutenant said, "We want to inspect the mine." So we went across the street. I went through the gate, and the 10 long white-coated guys rushed the gate, and the mine director waved them off, and we went in and saw the lab inside with all of the lab work that they do in a situation like that. And as we're touring the lab, I stopped by a kiln. The mine director looked at me, and he walked over, and he opened up the microwave-sized kiln, and there were some tobacco leaves in there. And he says, "Für mein Rauchen," for my smoking. And then we went down to the elevator. And as I recall, before the elevator, there were parts of another aircraft, and I didn't recognize any of the parts, so it must have been maybe one of the V-1 or V-2 rockets. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so he says, "I'm sorry, but I can't take you down to the mine. We don't have any steam in the boilers, so, and then we can't use the elevators." So he said, "Come back tomorrow, and I'll take you down." So on that, I hopped on the cycle and back, shotgun, and we rode off. Then we went through the canyons and so on. Then we stopped and we discussed the situation. The lieutenant says, "Let's go back now," about an hour later when we left. And he said, "We'll give them time to get the boilers up and see what it is." Because he says, "There's a lot of white flags that were coming in, showing us when we went in." He says, "They must have thought we were the advanced scouts of a large American force. Otherwise, they would have killed us for sure."
Because there were a lot more of them than there were of you.
We had no chance.
It was two of you.
That's the two of us. And eventually, we did go down the salt mines to the shaft, down to the bottom. And that's when both of us, found the German village, Ransbach, and its salt mine. And ultimately, we went down, and I found all sorts of things. I took with me 2 16th century, 500-year-old legal books, one in German and one in Latin. And also in that Ransbach, I found thousands of opera costumes, which later was sent to all the major opera houses in Europe and the United States.
So you're an 18-year-old kid, and you're in this mine. You don't know how much danger you're in, and then you're seeing all these things that probably don't have an obvious explanation. And so what you learned eventually was that those books and other books like them and opera costumes, that they were sent to the salt mine for safekeeping because there was so much bombing going on, all these priceless artifacts would have been lost. So they were put there for safekeeping. You found them. You held on to those books for quite a long time, but you don't have them anymore. What happened?
I contacted the National Archives to see if they could help me. I contacted the lead archivist, Greg Bradshaw, and he was interested, particularly when I told him I have the books. We went back and forth email for months and months and months.
And so what you learned eventually was that those books and other books like them and opera costumes, that they were sent to the salt mine for safekeeping because there was so much bombing going on, all these priceless artifacts would have been lost. So they were put there for safekeeping. You found them. You had them for decades. You talk to the archives and they say, we'll try to get them back to where they belong. And they are now back in Germany?
Yes. I returned them to Klaus Schiroff, German ambassador. There was a ceremony for me to give the books back. When I gave the books back to the ambassador, he says, Bob, when you two left the salt mine, the people in Ransbach had been walking around in rags for years. They wanted and needed new clothes. Since you two left, there's no one to guard the entrance. So the villagers knew that the Germans had stored all kinds of things down in the salt mine. So they decided to go down. They climbed down wooden ladders because the elevators were not working, no steam in the boilers. But they did climb down into the mine, 2,500 feet, and found the opera costumes. When they found the opera costumes, they carried them back up to their villages. Soon, all the other villagers sent out warnings to all the villages. Do not go to the village of Ransbach. They have the strangest people walking around in the weirdest clothes. I thank the laughing ambassador. One thing I should tell you, and that is, I went overseas with 17,000 of us on the Queen Mary, and ultimately I ended up alone in Metz, France. The train dropped me off, and I walked down this tunnel, dark tunnel. You could see a light at the far end. And as I'm walking down the tunnel, I can hear my boots hit the stone floor. A voice behind me says, can I help you, sir? And I turn my head around, and here was this 6'4" black man with a turban on his head. I was so frightened because I didn't hear any sounds when he approached me from the rear that I just stood there. So he took my bags and led me to the light at the end of the tunnel. And so when I went into the end of the tunnel, it led into this big open space bordered by stone walls and buildings. It was dark now. You could see all kinds of big kettles with boiling water. And so what you do is they handed me a rifle, and it was wrapped in orange wax paper and covered with cosmoline, which is a grease. I was told to boil it and clean it. So we did. 12 of us then were loaded aboard the truck, and we were driven to the front. Snipers all the time waiting away. And then they dropped us off at a fortress in the Siegfried Line. Siegfried Line was a concrete fortress, a line of them, hundreds of them, and they're all below ground. So we finally got off the truck and made our way in, and I ended up first in the Siegfried Line. So we would go down. By that time, there were 8 of us. We lost some just walking on the road. We could hear artillery fire in the distance, and we continued on the truck, and we're told to get off and wait for the old men. The old men were fellows that had been on the line for a month. And so we went into the bunker, and there were GIs laying all over in the bunker, and the walls were covered with black soot, and water running down the sides, and you could see little fires burning, guys laying on the floor and all that. The light was made by burning composition 2 plastic explosive. And so some were cooking by that. It would be pitch dark, but they were burning plastic explosives to give off light. But it gave everybody headaches. So that's, we were just in there shortly, and a second lieutenant stood up, and he says, "Welcome to General George Patton, 90th Infantry Division, 358 Regiment. Vibrations and gunfire outside." And he says, "We just had a break in our lines, later called the Battle of Bulge." Mm-hmm. And our role was to go down the trenches to a fort, and it's just below ground level. And so as we went down there, we would see the door and a little area open. We would run up to the gate, run up to a door or doors, and we would put plastic C2 explosive on the door and blow the door off. And when we did that, we would run right into the fort then, and we would shoot anything that was holding a weapon. You have to act fast because they all are armed. You learn you have to be fast because every fort we had to break in, they were armed men in there. When I say, talk about a fort or fortress or bunkers, all the same. When I was near the end of the Siegfried Line to go into a village clearing, I was the first one through the entrance of the bunker. And about 12 feet away, I see this person. We had just blown the door. So this person was small. The uniform was too big, about 12 feet away. The helmet framed the very small face, and the eyes were looking right at me, and he was standing, getting up on one knee, and he was pointing a BRRRP automatic weapon gun right at me, and I shot him first. If I had not shot him, he was armed with a very fast automatic weapon, BRRRP gun. Then he would have killed me and all my buddies behind. So after I shot him, I ran out of the bunker.
How old do you think that young man was?
10 years old. I had no choice. Otherwise, he would have killed me and all my buddies.
But that knowledge that he'd been forced to kill a child soldier is something that haunted him for decades. When we come back, what happened 60 years later that freed Bob from recurring nightmares? 93-year-old Bob Thomas is our guest today. You can find photos of him then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And we'll be right back after this.